I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Len Goodman, professor of philosophy, and Andrew Mellon, professor of humanities, about his recent book, Creation and Evolution. Len, thanks for joining me in this interview.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
Great. All right. Well, we're going to start off with a kind of a general question about your book, particularly the purposes of your book. There are quite a few, as you probably know, quite a few recent books by scientists, philosophers, theologians who are theistic, atheistic, agnostic, about the struggle between creation and evolution, or more generally, the struggle between religion and science. And I was wondering how you feel that your book contributes to this larger conversation.
Well, there's a couple of things that I think I can contribute. One is that there tends to be a lot of people talking past each other in those debates. Each side has its own preferred audience. They don't really expect people outside that little niche to be even listening to them or reading their material. My book does a couple of things. First of all, I'm trying to get at the roots of the trouble, conceptually and historically. What motivates people to be fearful of evolution? What motivates other folks to be fearful of religion? I think, to some extent, Darwinism has become a kind of football that gets kicked back and forth between those two camps who don't pay much attention to each other's motives and concerns. Another thing that happens in my book is I look very closely at what Darwin really had to say, how his argument works, what the evidence has been that has accrued since Darwin's time, which is very substantial and very impressive. And I look very closely at the biblical account of creation. What's at stake there? I think a lot of folks have imposed their own theological notions and their own political and moral notions onto that story. I have access to material, and I want to provide the readers of this book access to material that would help to motivate that story and help them see what it's about. It's not particularly about refuting Darwin or the various notions that have been pegged to Darwin's name ever since his own time.
Okay. Well, we'll move right into talking about your book, and I wanted to start with the first chapter. We're not going to look in detail at every chapter, but I wanted to pick out a few things that I found particularly interesting or had particular questions about. In the first chapter, you talk about the history of the conflict.
Yes.
Between creationists and Darwinians. And what was interesting to me was how you actually found a commonality between creation and evolution in terms of the idea of eternalism. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yes. Our way of looking at explanation today is very much influenced by Darwin. That is, we think that we can explain things by understanding their history. That certainly has not always been the case for much of the history of human thought on the subject of explanation. Very much influenced by Aristotle, the idea was that you explain something by understanding what its nature is and why it has to be the way it is. There's a rejection of historical explanation that runs through much of the history of Western science based on the fear that historical explanations are mythic and they're substitutes for explanation. Whereas Darwin brings us back to the biblical idea that you can understand things in terms of understanding their origins. You can use a historical narrative as a method of analysis of taking things apart and understanding what would have happened, what could have happened, what should have happened, what wouldn't have happened unless something else had happened. That's something very much in common. Now eternalism, which became a very prominent dogma for much of the history of science, down to Darwin's time, thought that the nature of things had never really changed, that it was unscientific to imagine the notion that species had developed or that species might go extinct. If you look at the biblical way of thinking of things, there's an idea very much in common with Darwin that things have developed, that the world has a history, that humanity has a history, that nature itself and the cosmos has a history. So there's common ground there. And if you look at the history of ideas back through the Middle Ages and on into modern times, you find that the big opposition to theism didn't come from the idea of evolution. It came from the worry that things had always been the way they are, and therefore maybe you didn't need the idea of God to explain how things had gotten the way they are, because the natures of things were sufficient to explain all of that.
How you just mentioned that there was a sense amongst people in the Middle Ages that of a threat to theism from this idea that you didn't need a god because things were already there. What kinds of problems do people have now, theists have now, with accepting a notion of Darwinian evolution? Yeah.
The problems that I see turn out, almost all of them, to have very little to do with biology. They have to do with a moral and social and sometimes political program that's been tacked onto Darwin, and Darwin has made the poster child of programmatics. In the 20s, for example, people were worried that Darwin was teaching everyone that might makes right, that survival of the fittest in biological terms somehow implied that the race or the individual or the enterprise that was stronger physically was somehow fated and therefore justified in dominating and indeed destroying and exterminating others. A lot of Christians are rightly worried about that kind of thinking, which has been fathered on Darwin. They look at the history of Marxism and the history of racism and the history of fascism, and they see Darwin as the source of that kind of idea and the advocate of that kind of idea. They think that Darwin precludes theism. They think that by precluding theism, Darwin precludes morality as well, or any morality that they would recognize as having merit and worth. And they want to find a way of rejecting or getting past the idea of evolution because of what they think are its social implications, or perhaps its social applications, and they don't always distinguish the two. And unfortunately, there are plenty of people around to give color to their fears. People who think that the preservation of science is the only basis of morality, or people who think that eugenics is really a good thing, or people who think that Darwin really did vindicate racist views or people who think that Darwin somehow entails that people can make up their own morality without any reference to scripture or tradition or any humane values other than those of scientism. So their fears are warranted by extremists of the other type. And these two schools of extremism polarize and indeed feed off one another, leaving the large middle ground less exciting and perhaps less readily discerned.
But beyond these, or in addition to these, this opposition to Darwinism from theists based on things not necessarily found in Origin of Species, there's also, obviously, as you talk about in your book and as you've already talked about in this interview, opposition based on a reading of Genesis, based on the reading of creation.
Well, there are different kinds of opposition mm-hmm. to Darwin, and one kind which is held by some evangelicals is that one has to take Scripture literally, and Darwin disagrees with Scripture, so Darwin must be wrong. One of the reasons I spend a lot of time in the second chapter of the book walking the reader through the original text of the narrative of creation in Genesis and through traditional commentaries on it, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, is that folks who have that kind of notion of literalism aren't usually very good at doing their literalism, don't really know exactly what the Bible says. They've tacked onto it a set of their own concerns. They think that, they like to call themselves biblical inerrantists. And they believe there's no untruth in the Bible, and they tend to worry about anything poetic in the Bible. But you know, the Bible, when it says the world was created in 6 days, is using the idea of the 6 days as a way of parsing creation. It doesn't intend that sentence to be taken literally. This is something that I argue in the book. Oddly enough, if you think in terms of the folks who are worried about defending a literal 6 days, and those, of course, are not the only opponents of neo-Darwinism, but they're a vocal group. If you look at the way they interpret other things, most of them, for example, celebrate the Sabbath on the first day rather than the seventh. There's suddenly a lot of latitude there about how they read the Bible. They're very free in reading Genesis to read into the account of Genesis all kinds of prefigurations of the Christ story. That's a very poetic kind of usage, and it's very important to their religion. But it's a far cry from reading the text literally. The attempt to read the text literally is a way of undermining its poetry, which is a very important part of the text. But when I say that Genesis uses poetic usages, I don't mean to say that it's not to be taken seriously, as if poetry is not serious, not important. The Bible has important theological and moral and social and political messages to convey. Part of my worry about literalism is that the attempt at literalism is a way of missing a lot of that. A couple of examples, if I may. Chris, the Bible has it that Adam gave birth to Eve. She was made out of his rib. You can worry a lot about exactly how that was done. The Bible isn't terribly interested in that question. What it is interested in is the moral it draws from that story, which Adam states explicitly. It's one of those places where the Bible explains itself. Adam says that she's flesh of his flesh and bone of his bone. The point of the story is that men and women aren't alien to one another, that there's no battle between the sexes, that the normative moral that's drawn is, therefore, does a man leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife? You're supposed to know that that's where your first loyalty is. It's not the case, according to the Bible, that blood is thicker than water. That is, your loyalty should be to your spouse and not to your and not primarily and inexorably to your parents, in lieu of your spouse. Now that's a point where the point of the story is made explicit, but the worry about how did you make a woman out of a man's rib misses the point of the story completely. It gets hung up on that. If I may offer a second example, the story of Noah. This, again, is a place where the Bible is very explicit about the point that it wants to draw. People have inordinately worried about where did all that water come from? And there are books written about huge layers of water that were up in the stratosphere or above it, and the ionosphere, and raining down on the earth. How were those animals taken care of? How were they fed? How did they keep the stalls clean? Who did the shoveling? That's not what the story of Noah is about. The story of Noah ends with a kind of moral or punchline where God creates the rainbow. And God, it's dramatized as though God were discovering something, which of course God already knew, that man has this tendency to wrongdoing from his youth. Not from birth, it's not a belief in original sin, but from his youth. There's this tendency to, this bent towards wrongdoing, and God says, as if it were a non sequitur, therefore he's not going to send another flood. What's the point of that therefore? It means that God has accepted that human nature is what it is, and God is not going to intervene and interfere. The story of Noah is dealing with the problem of evil. It's dealing with the question of why does God tolerate the terrible things that are done? And the answer that the book of Genesis gives is that God understands human nature, God thinks it's worthwhile for human beings to exist, and God is going to keep hands off and not interfere with human choices. That's what our freedom is based on. Now that idea of the rainbow and God not interference seed time and harvest will continue, that's the point of the story. The point of the story is not that there was a worldwide flood and Noah ended up on Mount Ararat all the animals on earth were killed and so forth. That's what the biblical author did in that case is to take an old topos of a worldwide flood and give it a new moral meaning. That God is concerned not with drinking a lot of beer as in the gods are in the Gilgamesh story, but the God of Israel is concerned with human morality. And although concerned with human morality, that's given into our hands and not to be constantly interfered with by God.
And this doesn't necessarily sum it up, but it's certainly something that you mentioned in the chapter. You say that these narratives are interested in what it is to be human.
Yes.
That evolution is more concerned with how we got to be where we are, but Genesis is about how are we human?
That's right. Well, you know, people like to point out that Adam and Eve didn't have a belly button. They're portrayed in the Bible as adults who have a language, who have responsibilities. They're supposed to take care of the garden. Who have strengths and weaknesses. They care about each other. They care for nature. And at the same time, weaknesses involving being attracted by what looks like it's worthwhile, and being easily deceived, and you know, the wonderful thing in the Jewish Midrash about the story of Adam and Eve. Adam eats the apple in one Midrash because, well, it isn't an apple, whatever fruit it was. Adam eats the fruit because he doesn't want to. He'd rather lose immortality than lose his partner. That's a beautiful and touching point. The analysis of human nature, the discovery of the depths and the dimensions of human character, the penetrating recognition of what it is to be human, of what it is to commit a crime, as Cain does, of what it is to feel guilt and remorse, and to be forgiven or let off the hook. Those things are part of the phenomenology of humanity. If you look at Darwin wants to explain how we got there. And that's a progress. That's a development which the Bible doesn't attempt to explain, and rightly so. It doesn't have the materials. It's not the subject matter that it's interested in. Darwin takes that for granted. Darwin takes a lot of things for granted because his account is an explanation of a certain sort. The Bible is trying to explain other sorts of things and to develop other sorts of ideas, including most centrally ideas of right and wrong, which of course the theory of evolution can't teach us.
When I was reading your chapters about your reading of Genesis, and you have a couple of chapters that are quite detailed, in my view, about a reading of Darwin, a reading of Darwinian evolution, a reading, a discussion of some of the problems that people have raised about it, the way that those problems have been addressed. Mm-hmm. One question that came to my mind, and maybe this harks back to the great middle that you were talking about earlier, I was wondering, in terms of audience, who is this book pitched towards? You know, you mentioned Henry Morris in your first chapter, who's the institute, is it
creation research? The Institute for Creation Research.
Yeah,
and he's an example of a biblical inerrantist.
And I can't imagine him reading your book and saying, "Oh yes, I agree with this." So I was just kind of, alternatively, maybe Daniel Dennett would have problems with it. So you know what?
I'm sure Daniel Dennett would. You know, Daniel Dennett is a very competent philosopher in his field, but when he wrote his book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, he dismisses what Spinoza had to say in a couple sentences. Sometimes when you get outside of your area, you're not always as profound as you think you are. I would love it if Daniel Dennett would read the book. I've met him. He's a very smart man. I'm hoping Phil Kitcher reads the book. I had a good conversation with him in New York not long ago. But there are a lot of people out there who are not full-time ideologues, who are people who want to take religion seriously but don't know if they can or how they can, people who certainly take science seriously, and they want to see how to fit these things together. Science is an important part of our lives. It's not something that we should bracket or compartmentalize. Religion is an important part of our lives, too. It's not something that we should outgrow. We shouldn't be keeping our religion on the Sunday school level. It's not a bunch of fables. It's not something that we have to be romantic about or put ourselves into an altered state of consciousness in order to appreciate. So I'm interested in the possibilities of integrating a scientific worldview with a philosophically serious religious point of view. And I find, in my experience, Chris, there are a lot of people out there who are very concerned with their ability to do just that. And I think one of the things that a philosopher can try and contribute, yes, by close reading of a text like Darwin or a text like Genesis, and by thinking hard about the issues and the problems and about what really motivates people to make a criticism and what motivates the responses to that criticism, I think one can do that kind of synthetic work, putting together ideas that look like they don't necessarily fit together. The audience that I have in mind is an audience of open-minded people, not people who are committed, not the people who can't wait to read the next book of Richard Dawkins because they already believe whatever he's going to say must be true. No, I don't think that somebody like Henry Morris is likely to read my book. As I said, I wish folks would, but that's a man with a cause, and he thinks that evolution is the root of all evil, at least in modern times, and he wants to overcome that, and I appreciate and understand that. I notice, if you want to talk about a brand of creationism that's a little more sophisticated than the Institute for Creation Research, I noticed that the intelligent design people, they're casting about. They don't know conceptually what to do about Darwinism. They're alarmed by it, they're concerned by it, and by the uses that it's been put to. They'd like to be able to make a distinction between those uses and the real content of the biology, but it's not so easy for them to do. So they don't believe in a young Earth, and they don't believe in this, and they don't believe in that, and they don't push the idea of theism either because they don't want to be branded as Bible thumpers. I think folks who have been motivated to be interested by intelligent design might be open to the recognition that what the strategy is that's been adopted by intelligent design is not a good strategy for theists to follow. It's an argument that I make in the book. It pushes God into the position of being a God of the gaps, something that you turn to and rely on when you're out of explanations and you're out of ideas. The notion is that biological species, living organisms, are so complex that there's never going to be a successful explanation of how they came about along evolutionary lines. I think that's a losing strategy for intelligent design people to follow, because what happens there to the theist is that as the science advances, God retreats. The light shines and God winds up in the shadows and in the cobwebs. What I think one has to recognize is that the question that the Bible is interested in, and the question that religions are interested in general, is the nature of value and of absolute value, and what's the relationship of value to our lives, and what's the relationship of value to the world. Theists believe that God is the ultimate value. That's what we mean when we say that God is good, and that God is love, and all the good things. God is wisdom, all the good things that we associate with God. The evolutionary story doesn't tell us why there's value in the world. And the difficulties that it may have in explaining how evolution took place aren't going to refute it. Science will work with those difficulties and will gradually, as science does, overcome them one by one. And maybe there'll be new theories, and maybe this theory will keep on producing the kind of fabulous results that it has up to now. But if you ask a different sort of question, not how did this come about and whether such and such an explanation is going to be able to explain it successfully or not, but the question of why does anything exist at all and why is there value in the world, that's a question that Darwin doesn't attempt to answer. And Darwinism presumes that there's value in the world. So there's an area of common ground between science and religion and an area where they don't conflict with one another. So I think one's on a better footing if one works that way. So coming back to your question about who's going to read this, I think people who are casting about and looking for a way to fit the religious ideas that they hold or have discovered or were raised with the scientific ideas that they've learned and think they believe in, fitting these things together and see what the strengths and limitations are of these two kinds of ideas, that's something that everybody who's living and breathing in this world we live in has to confront.
You just alluded to what you take up in the final chapter of your book, where you bring Darwinism and theism together. And we'll talk a little bit about it. We can't go into detail about it, but every aspect. But you claim, you argue that, as you've just been saying, Darwinian evolution is completely compatible with theism. And central to your claim is your discussion of teleology.
Yes.
That teleology or ends, and you can give a better explanation of it than that if you wish, it's implicit in the theory of evolution. So I'd like to ask why you think this is the case and how does that support your overall argument?
Sure. I think that's a wonderful question. You look back at the whole history of Western ideas. I blamed Aristotle for dismissing historical explanations, so I ought to at least out of fairness give Aristotle credit for the importance of purposes that he saw. Aristotle was very interested in living organisms, and in fact the word organism comes from the word organ, which is the Greek for tool. Our organs are tools; they perform functions. They do so well or badly. Badly, that's what we call disease. Well, that's what we call health. And all these organs function for a purpose, to keep the organism alive, and beyond that, to allow us to reproduce, to allow the species to continue. And as we know now, with the help of Darwin, if the species is going to continue, it's probably not necessarily going to stay the same. In a dynamic environment, species are going to have to change if they're going to continue in life. In a very static environment, maybe they can carry on. If they've got their own little niche, the cockroach will probably be with us, may outlast us. But species in general have to change. All this functioning of organs and changing of species is done in the interest of purposes. Now, what Darwin does, very, very interesting move, and it's in keeping with what we were talking about before, about thinking of explanation in historical terms, used to be that fitness and adaptation were thought of as something fixed and static. An organism had adaptations to its environment. That meant it was fit in its environment. Darwin sees that the environment is dynamic and that the fitness of the organism is something itself that's going to have to change. He's going to turn the idea of adaptation from a static situation into a dynamic one, and he's going to explain how that comes about. And the way he explains it, of course, is through the idea of natural selection, that there are organisms which are better or lesser fit in their environments. He's very successful in doing that, and all of modern biology, every branch of biology, ecology and physiology, every branch of biology, rests on Darwin's success in explaining those things. If you want to know what the evidence for evolution is, you don't look for some skeleton or fossil that's supposed to be the missing link. You look at the amount of biological understanding that's available from the theory of evolution, the way in which it explains so many different things. Now, that means that the idea of purpose is not something that Darwin does away with, as some philosophers have imagined and some biologists have imagined, but not all biologists. The idea of purpose in a living organism is the thing that Darwin wants to explain. How it comes about, how it changes, how it gets improved for the conditions of a new environment so that the organism can continue to survive and the species can continue to survive and the line which might change from the nature of that species can continue to survive. So that's my first point, that Darwin doesn't eliminate the idea of purpose. Darwin doesn't substitute mechanism for purpose. He gives a historical explanation of the evolution of purpose. You do away with the idea of purpose and you've done away with the idea of adaptation, which is the heart of the theory of evolution. That's what the theory of evolution is about. That's what it's trying to explain. If that's so, then my theological point, which is what you're driving at, is that Darwin can explain how purposes change, how they develop. He can't explain, and he doesn't pretend to, why there should be such a thing as purposes at all. Why is there an interest, which is the interest of the individual? Why does the interest of the individual overflow its bounds and become an interest in the preservation of one's young? Why does that interest overflow its bounds still further and become not just a maintenance of homeostasis or a maintenance of stability as if we were back in the world where species don't change, but actually becomes an ongoing, growing, emergent kind of developing good, so that what's good for, the cockroach, relatively simple compared to what's good for a human being. One of the interesting differences that happens, and I talk about this in the book, is that as species evolve, they take a larger and larger part in defining their own interest. And that's very distinctive to the human species in particular. We decide what our interests are. Not entirely. Not entirely. It's not entirely in our hands, but it's much more in our hands than it is in the hands of an ant. Purpose itself is an emergent characteristic. It grows, it develops. That's part of what evolves. And we have more autonomy, we have more community, we have shared interests, we have self-defined interests, we have intellectual and spiritual and moral interests that vastly expand the scope of who we are and what we do. The growth of the idea of interests and the seeds from which that growth comes are one of the things that all the religions of the world are interested in. And the Bible is particularly interested in that and has things to say about the nature of the good and what our purposes are, which will never be replaced by new scientific discoveries. The discoveries will tell us more and more about the world in which we live and about how those purposes can be realized and have been realized, both biologically and intellectually. It's never going to tell us why there should be such a thing as interest at all.
Another item in this final chapter, well, you talk about a number of other concepts. You talk about value, you talk about chance, necessity. One of the concepts you talk about that was particularly intriguing to me was the concept of grace.
Yes.
You say, quote, "Nature's great theme is grace manifest in the gift of being and its dynamism, possibility of life and growth, advantage and advance," unquote. And I was wondering, as I read the chapter, what you mean by grace and how that's part of the part of your argument about the compatibility of theism and Darwinian evolution.
I shouldn't just let pass the mention of chance, because that's an sure, important theme sure. at the end of the book too. So let's say something about chance and grace.
Sure.
And maybe about the idea that there's a connection between the two, which is an important theme in that last chapter. I think a lot of theists have been worried about the idea of chance. The thing that we know from genetics, the thing that we thought we knew back in the 1950s about genetics was that genetic mutations are a random event, and thus the Nobel Prize winning biologist Monod wrote a book called Chance and Necessity, which is basically a revival of Democritus's 5th century BC idea that chance is what's in charge of the world. He put that emphasis on chance because he knows that that mutations are random. Now, if that means that mutations are random with respect to the interests of the organism, I think we've got to say that that's true. The cosmic ray, as they used to call it, that comes from outer space and strikes the chromosome and knocks one of your base pairs out of position and causes a genetic defect, which causes a protein defect, which causes mental retardation or some other serious condition. That piece of radiation didn't strike that gene on purpose, or out of hostility, or out of any kind of plan. It just happened, and that's a random event, and that's a fact. If we're going to live in the world, we're going to be subject to that kind of event, and I don't think it's a big discovery of 20th century genetics that we are subject to that kind of event. That's been known as long as people have noticed that lightning strikes and disease strikes and so forth. However, we know a lot more about genetics than they knew in the 1950s, and one of the things we know is that there's a lot of self-regulation that goes on in genetics. Genetic systems themselves evolve. One of the things that they evolve most remarkably is sexual reproduction. What we find with sexual reproduction is that the genetic deck of cards gets shuffled. We can shuffle the deck without shredding the cards. That's a remarkable way of allowing for genetic variation, which is the raw material of evolution, without losing valuable developments, valuable adaptations that have accrued in the past. It's a remarkable thing. This means that things are not so random as they might appear. It's not just a crap game. It's a It's an emergent system in which there is, as I indicated before, progressively more control available for the organism, for the species, for the lineage that the species is involved in. This is an example of an emergent good. Chance here plays a role for sure, but it's not the sort of uncaring, vicious, brutal, crude sort of chance that we might picture when that word is used. It becomes one of the tools of evolution itself, and that leads to your idea, to your interest in grace. Because grace, as I'm using the word here, means the opportunity that nature affords. Theists believe that being is good, and the development of being is good, and the possibilities of being are good. That's why we believe in love. That's why we believe in caring. That's why we believe in human opportunity. Nature is such that it makes room for growth and for development and for intellectual exploration and discovery and for evolution. So I take evolution and the possibility of evolution to be a sign of grace. So the fact that we see these opportunities in nature will be taken by the theist as evidence of the benignity of God, whom we think of as the creator of nature. A lot of people want their idea of God to be based on faith. I worry about that because you always have to wonder, faith in what, and who determines what the content of faith is going to be, and it's supposed to be a leap, but which direction do you jump in? I think I feel that it's more appropriate intellectually to ground oneself in the world one lives in and to base one's faith on one's understanding. So when you see opportunity and space and the chance for development, whether it's biological development or of the individual or the species, whether it's evolution or whether it's spiritual and moral, intellectual growth, those are the signs of grace, and the theist attributes those opportunities to the act of God.
Would it be fair to say that you are arguing that Darwinism entails theism of a sort? I mean, you're making a fairly strong argument, it seems to me, that science, Darwinian evolution in particular, is only going to go so far. There's that aspect, and then the why questions are in the realm of outside of the realm of evolution. But beyond that, you're arguing that there's this notion of purpose in Darwinian evolution that can't be explained itself by Darwinian evolution or by science. You have to move beyond science. So are you, I mean, is there an entailment going on?
The only hesitation I have is about the word entailment.
Okay.
You know, you ask a philosopher about entailment, immediately the notion is you're going to talk about something deductive. I don't think that you could deduce theism from Darwinism. But then again, I don't think you could deduce Darwinism from the evidence either. Look back at what I said about explanation earlier on in our conversation. What makes Darwin a strong theory, what makes the theory of evolution by natural selection a strong theory, is its power to explain so many things. Now, the things that Darwinism explains could be explained in other ways. We think that Darwinism is a good theory, is a true theory, because it's the best explanation we could think of. It's the best explanation we've got for all this great variety of things. And there is what the great 19th century philosopher of science, William Whewell, called consilience. There's a coming together of evidence from different quarters. What kind of evidence is it? Well, it's evidence that you could explain on the assumption that Darwin is right, over here, over there, over the other place. Putting things together in that way is the way Darwinism works. I think theism works the same way. I think we've got human caring, and we've got those purposes we've been talking about, and we've got the way chance is conducive to growth and development and evolution, and we've got that beautiful operation of sexual reproduction, which makes it something more than reproduction and a means, in fact, of variation in a controlled sort of biological fashion. You put all these things together, now theism is not the only possible way of explaining those, so you couldn't say that it's entailed by that evidence, but it is a very strong and embracing sort of explanation, which fits well with the evidence that we know. You said I was making a strong claim, and there I think you were using the word exactly the way philosophers want to use the word strong. It's a strong claim in the sense that I don't think that theism is merely consistent with evolution. I think that theism provides us a very good way of understanding nature and the world we live in, including the evolutionary dimensions of that we understand through biology.
And I think I'll go ahead and ask the final question, this has to do with partly with the title of your book, but it kind of draws out from that. The title of your book is Creation and Evolution.
Yes.
It's not Creation versus Evolution.
No.
I was wondering if it could be Creation / Evolution, and meaning by that, where do you see creation ending and evolution beginning? Are they so wrapped up in one another that they're almost synonymous?
Okay. I think you read very perceptively. You're right that the "and" was meant to connect rather than disconnect creation and evolution. What's the nature of that connection? I don't think that they're identical. People who study evolution use certain methods. They're scientific methods. It's very interesting. I think some people have been raised with the notion that there is something called the scientific method. Philosophers of science, for the most part, don't believe that anymore. One of the reasons they don't believe it is because Darwin's own work expanded and modified our understanding of the way scientific understanding works. He wasn't generalizing over a bunch of instances, for example. He was explaining a variety of different phenomena according to certain assumptions. The methods that people who think and wonder and ask questions about God use are not the same methods that the scientists use, and I wouldn't recommend that they that either group adopt or try to adopt the methods of the other. If we ask questions about reality at large, that's what philosophers call metaphysics, and asking questions about reality at large is never going to lend itself to scientific exploration, where you're trying to control a situation and rule out all the extraneous factors and narrow it down to just one little piece of information. Was this the thing that caused that, or was something else the thing that caused that? That's a very valuable and very powerful method, But when you look at reality at large, oh, you got to use a different method. And the method that I recommend is one of openness and thoughtfulness and reflecting on what others in other periods and other traditions and other personality types as from one's own. What have they thought? How do they contribute? What you want to try and do, and it's a very challenging thing, and some people think it's impossible, what you want to try and do is thematize reality. Now, I think, and I think most theists think, that that one of the big themes of reality is grace that we were talking about before. I think if you want to try and explain the existence of anything at all, which is, in our view, an act of grace, if you want to try and explain why there's good and why there's value and why there's caring and why there's purpose and why species evolve, the idea of divine love is a very powerful and helpful sort of explanation. Some people think that there's no such thing as that kind of love, and some people think that other things take precedence to it, and evil and suffering predominate. I think that's a skewed view and a sort of self-serving one. Self-serving in the sense that people think it liberates them to do whatever they like anyway, so they can forget about that. It's important to me that people who worry about suffering, as we should, have to recognize that suffering is only bad because it interferes with the good and the joy and the love. In other words, suffering is parasitic on the goodness of reality, and that goodness comes first, and that's what the theist is trying to explain. But the methods that the theist uses in trying to explain it are not going to be scientific methods. Neither should they be methods which ignore the findings of science, but neither should the scientist ignore the insights and the wisdom of religion. Because, after all, you look at the things that a great scientist like Darwin took for granted, the idea of adaptation, for example, that he was trying to explain, the idea that there are interests and purposes that organisms are trying to pursue, that's not something which his theory could explain. He's going to have to go outside that theory and look to some kind of religious idea in order to give it an explanation. Otherwise, the little things that we can explain will turn back upon bigger things that we cannot, and we'll be left with no explanation whatever.
Len, thank you. Thank you for this conversation.
It's a great pleasure, Chris. Thank you for doing this.
Again, I've been talking with Len Goodman, author of the recent book, Creation and Evolution, published by Routledge. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thank you for listening.